you have the chance to win a Spring Super Sweeps from LAist. Donate $60 for one entry to win a brand new Lexus or $25,000 in cash. Check out all the other prizes too when you donate now at LAist.com/sweeps.
In case you just joined us, we have good news in California. State Department of Public Health says both Los Angeles and Orange counties tomorrow move into the less restrictive orange tier of the pandemic. That is the least restrictive color-coded tier we've been in since the state 7 months ago initiated that system, those tiers for restrictions. And we're awaiting word from the public health authorities with the two counties themselves as to when they're going to be adopting the less restrictive measures on restaurants, on bars, and other indoor facilities. That just coming to us, and we'll have updates through you throughout the course of the day here on KPCC. Also, I was thinking about Kemp Powers, who's going to be on with A. Martinez on Take Two this afternoon. You know, One Night in Miami is a play that he wrote, which he then adapted to film, which, you know, not all playwrights get that opportunity to do the film adaptation. And, of course, then for him to be nominated for both, yes, an extraordinary year for Kemp Powers, no question about it. On Air Talk, we now turn our attention to the law with Columbia Law School professor Jamal Green. His new book, How Rights Went Wrong, Why Our Obsession with Rights is Tearing America Apart. Professor Green, so good to have you with us on Air Talk.
Thanks. Good to be here.
So let's sort of set the establishing framework here for your book. You write that the sort of zero-sum game of determining whose rights supersedes whose creates tremendous problems within the American political and legal system. Elaborate a bit on that.
Sure. We tend to think about rights as almost absolute. We take this kind of a binary frame. Either I have a right and the right enables me to do certain things and the government can't interfere with that, or else I don't have a right, in which case the government gets to do whatever it wants. And that's ends up being a very polarizing language because it associates the Constitution's protections with one side of a dispute or the other, as opposed to trying to figure out a language of reconciliation. I'm thinking about, you know, for example, right, you know, just this morning, seeing lots of discussion about, you know, vaccine passports and people saying, I have a right to not have to show a passport or carry my health information around. We think of that, our political debates turn into these kind of legalized disputes about who holds the right and who doesn't hold the right. And that's not just polarizing, but also ends up taking us away from conversations about justice, which are really about much more contextual facts.
Well, and you use the example among many in your book of Roe v. Wade, and whose right is it, the woman who's pregnant or the fetus? Does the fetus have rights in that issue of abortion? And at least American public opinion polls that I see show a rather nuanced view when it comes to the topic of abortion. So what would be an example when it comes to abortion law of moving it away from a sort of zero-sum rights game?
Well, there's an example in the book that where there's a really interesting parallel universe in Germany. From all the way from back in the 1970s when Roe versus Wade is first decided. And in Roe, the Supreme Court says that the value of fetal life is not something that's of constitutional value. And the court says, you know, the reason we have to say that is because if we didn't say that, then that means we can't protect the rights of the woman. So it kind of pits these two things as opposites and things that can't be optimized at the same time. The German Constitutional Court, getting a similar case at the same time, says, you know, you've got to take both of these rights and both of these values seriously constitutionally. And what ends up happening is the debate around abortion rights in Germany ends up focusing on how do you actually reduce the number of abortions? Both sides end up focusing a lot of attention on on prenatal care, on child care services, on employment guarantees. So you end up taking it out of the realm of, well, either you've got to pick one person's right or another, and forcing it into a more political conversation. And there are ways that courts can actually do that.
How do you then avoid having a local jurisdiction pass a law that, at least in the perspective of many, would be an infringement, say in this case, of the mother's right to an abortion? So you have a state passes a very restrictive law on abortion. How do you then use this sort of commonality approach to resolve that?
Well, look, we can't use the Constitution to take us away from the fact that we disagree fundamentally about lots and lots of things. What the book tries to do is not to say, look, there's a way of solving this that will make everyone hold hands and sing Kumbaya. It's to say that there are ways of solving these or of addressing these problems that force us to ask the right kinds of questions, right? So the right kind of question in an abortion rights dispute, and this is of course the most sensitive possible area, but the right kinds of questions in an abortion rights dispute have to do with what kinds of choices are available to women. Is the state able to pursue values that within our tradition we think are important values, like the value of life? Are there ways of reconciling those in the same space? And maybe there aren't in certain cases, depending on what kind of law we're talking about. But we have to talk about what the law is, right? So a law that says you've got to have a waiting period, or a law that says that that people who perform abortions, doctors who perform abortions, have to get certain kinds of hospitalization privileges, say, is different from a law that says you can't have an abortion after 6 weeks or something, when most people don't know whether they're pregnant or not. We've got to focus on the particular facts of the law at issue, and that's the only way to have a conversation about our values. We can't abstract away from that and say, are you going to pick the pro-choice side, or are you going to pick the pro-life side? Because, as you say, most Americans actually feel like there's some value on both those sides.
We're talking with constitutional scholar, professor at Columbia Law School, Jamal Green, joining us. His new book, How Rights Went Wrong, Why Our Obsession with Rights is Tearing America Apart. If you have questions on what Professor Green is saying, you want to add into our conversation, you're very welcome to do so at 866-893-KPECC. You can also comment with a tweet at Twitter. I'm sorry, at AirTalk on Twitter, on the AirTalk Facebook page, or on the AirTalk page at kpcc.org. You point out that, and correct me if I'm mischaracterizing this, but that the NAACP fighting back against Jim Crow laws really brought to prominence an assertion of constitutional rights as a way to fight against that. And yeah, I've always thought of, you know, one of the things that is very different about America and its founding is the Bill of Rights and the notion of rights, individual rights, being so central in the foundation of the story. Now, of course, that's even as many Americans' rights were run roughshod over by the government itself. But speak to that sort of history and the notion of rights under the law.
Sure, we do tend to go all the way back to the founding when we talk about rights. And certainly when I talk about the book, I often hear about the Declaration of Independence or the Bill of Rights, and as this source of kind of absolute super strong individual rights. That's not how the founders would have understood the rights that they were protecting in those documents. The Declaration of Independence talks about unalienable rights, but then in the very next sentence says that's why governments are instituted among men. And the reason the Declaration says that is because the founders' conception of rights was very much a communal conception. Rights were compatible with self-government. Indeed, the reason why we have self-government is in order to protect our rights. And you can go through the whole Bill of Rights, and it's really about protecting institutions of self-government. As you say, there are lots of reasons why that doesn't make any sense and fails in the universe that in which they found themselves, which is a universe in which they are not only excluding people from self-government, but actually terrorizing people who are not included, right? So that it doesn't work in the founders' generation. But a lot of the rest of American history has been trying to marry the idea that self-government is actually very important and is a very important way of pursuing our rights with the notion that self-government has to be inclusive. So rights have to be married to some idea of pluralism. That's where the NAACP comes in. And eventually, after lots of problematic interpretations of the Constitution, by the middle of the 1950s and into the civil rights movement, we start to take seriously the rights of excluded minorities in ways that were not taken seriously before. But the problem is that we then end up associating the very idea of rights with the same kinds of civil rights instincts developed in the middle of the 20th century. The idea that when you have a right, that means someone's being oppressive or abusive in some way. Of course, that makes sense when you're talking about Jim Crow, when the government is pathological and abusive. But most rights claims don't involve an abusive government. They involve a government that's trying to pursue some interest that might also take the form of rights, right? So rights to public health or rights to safety from guns, or the government's trying to administer a welfare program and they're doing it clumsily or ham-handedly, and there are some rights at issue on the other side. Most rights conflicts involve rights claims on both sides of the dispute, both the government law and the individual right, and that's what we need to figure out how to reconcile.
And I guess what I struggle with a bit is sort of who determines what's abusive. And I'm not equating any other government law with Jim Crow laws in the severity, but nonetheless, there is still the question of where you put that line. And for example, gun rights advocates would argue that there are certain gun control laws that are abusive to the Second Amendment. And again, I'm not equating that with Jim Crow laws, but that label of abusive, it seems to me, could be used rather widely, Professor.
No, that's right. And that, I think, does speak to the fact that we disagree with each other on these things. So one of the key lessons of the book is the reason we have rights disputes in the United States is not because a bunch of us are right about our rights and the rest of us are wrong, right? Some of us are angels and the rest are devils. It's because we're all different from one another. And so we have very different values, and we're going to disagree about gun rights disputes. But the question that we should be asking, legal decision makers should be asking in those disputes, are questions about burdens and benefits. They shouldn't be abstract questions about whether we have a right to bear arms, because of course we do. And we also have a right to protect ourselves through public safety laws. And so the question is not a question of which of those rights is correct, right? It's a question of how are they optimized? What is the evidence that a particular law is actually protective? What's the evidence of the burden on a gun owner? Are there ways of passing a public safety measure that are not as burdensome? What alternatives are available? Those are the kinds of questions that legal decision makers should be asking, and that they don't ask enough. We tend to reduce these kinds of really trenchant rights disputes into questions of who has the right and who doesn't have the right.
We're talking with Columbia Law School professor and constitutional scholar Jamal Green. His new book, How Rights Went Wrong, Why Our Obsession with Rights is Tearing America Apart. I'm fascinated by the book because it's just such a totally different way of framing how we see the role of the courts and the degree of a freedom that we give judge to define whose rights should supersede someone else's. We're taking your calls. If you have questions for Professor Green, we're at 866-893-KPCC. Back in just 1 minute. Constitutional scholar, noted law professor from Columbia Law School, Jamal Green, is with us on Air Talk. His new book, How Rights Went Wrong, Why Our Obsession with Rights is Tearing America Apart. Just a reminder, coming up on Fresh Air in just a few minutes on KPCC, the writer and producer of the series Lovecraft Country, Misha Green, will be on Fresh Air, and then A. Martinez with Kemp Powers, who co-directed and wrote the Pixar animated film Soul, which is nominated for Best Animated Feature. Powers also nominated for Best Adapted Screenplay, an adaptation of his own play, One Night in Miami. That's coming up at 2, Take 2 with A. Martinez here on KPCC. Professor Green, let's talk a bit about how the balance of power might be changed by what you're proposing here in sort of a mediation of rights as opposed to which rights supersedes another. We think of the courts as a check and a balance, and not just the Supreme Court, on the legislative branch. And it seems to me, and again, you know, if you think I'm mischaracterizing it, please correct me, but that you're talking about a bit more of the power being held legislatively, the power of the people, as opposed to the courts to keep the people in check, so to speak, when they want to run roughshod over what's deemed the rights of minorities. So how would you keep this from diminishing the power of the courts?
Well, I'm not opposed to diminishing the power of the courts. I wouldn't eliminate it entirely, but the idea that our rights disputes are primarily disputes to be determined by courts, deciding cases on the basis of their legal training. So looking at, you know, where do they put this comma in a 200-year-old text, or what did Madison think about a controversy about which he had no opinion? That's the right way to resolve really contextual, really value-laden rights disputes seems to me not well justified. That there has to be political involvement. And by political, I don't mean senators and presidents necessarily, but I mean the polity, the rest of us citizens also have a role to play in resolving disputes about rights. And the ways in which people resolve disputes they disagree about is by engaging in politics, by passing laws, by having policies, by negotiating about the shape and contours of those policies. That's the framers' vision of empowering local communities and local self-government. That's what the Bill of Rights is really about. And we've got to figure out how to update that vision for an America that includes lots and lots of people who have very, very, very different values. Not to say the courts have no role to play. They do have a role to play in setting the boundaries of that conversation, but we can't outsource these questions to courts as if the Constitution has some particular answer to questions of the right balance between gun safety and Second Amendment rights. That's an answer that we've got to work out politically. And again, the courts can set some boundaries to that conversation, but it has to be worked out in negotiated fashion. That's how we work out our rights disputes.
If you don't use a sort of a hierarchy of rights to resolve that, how do you then frame that conversation? What's the starting point and the boundaries to that effort to find commonality?
So I used the example of the Second Amendment, and it's really hard to do this in the abstract. And that's sort of part of the point of the book is that asking different kinds of laws have different effects on people, are motivated by different reasons, have different evidence that supports those reasons, and those are all really important. So a law that's passed in a concealed carry law that's passed in some jurisdiction that's based on some understanding of the level of public safety required. That's not something that, you know, staring at the Constitution for a long time is not going to tell us whether a people that wants to protect itself from the prevalence of guns and gun violence, or people who feel like they have a Second Amendment right to lawfully carry firearms. The Constitution just can't tell us the answers to those questions, right? So we can take it away from the Constitution entirely, but I go back to thinking that judges actually are important in setting some bounds. And so one of those bounds might be, well, you've got to give people some freedom to carry firearms in a lawful and peaceful way. Another bounds might be that if a state is genuinely and in good faith trying to protect public safety, then it has to get some deference in how it structures the law to do that. Now, and judges make those kinds of judgments all the time, judgments about good faith, judgments about the evidence that's being relied upon, judgments on how costly a particular law is for an individual. And it's got to be a judgment call ultimately. Again, we're going to disagree about these things, and different judges are going to reach different views. the book is about what are the right questions to ask.
Well, and wouldn't it all be pegged to an interpretation of the Second Amendment or completely independent of that?
Well, the Second Amendment is relevant in setting the boundaries, right? So in the absence of the Second Amendment, we might not necessarily think there is an individual right to bear arms, but it's there. And so we need to figure out what to do with it and also be a self-governing democracy at the same time.
Professor Green, thank you so much for talking with us about your new book. We really appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
Columbia Law Professor Jamal Green, How Rights Went Wrong, Why Our Obsession with Rights is Tearing America Apart. Thank you so much for joining us for Air Talk on KPCC. I'll, of course, be back tomorrow morning at 10 for Air Talk. We'll be talking about COVID-19 vaccination with one of our medical authorities. We'll also talk about this week when a number of public school districts welcome students back onto their campuses. We'll hear what parents have to say about how the first few days of this new experience being back on campus, what that's been like. Have a wonderful afternoon from all of us here at Air Talk.
The LAS Spring Super Sweeps is happening now. You can win amazing prizes while supporting your source for local fact-based journalism. One lucky grand prize winner will get to choose a brand new Lexus or $25,000 in cash. Other prizes include an electric bike from Juice Bikes and $1,000 gas gift cards. Your donation of $60 gets you one entry to win, and the more you give, the more entries you get. Donate now at las.com/sweeps.